Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks to the organizers for having me here. I've been learning a lot these days and hope to learn more info. So I'm from ICP. ICP, here is the ICP campus in near Trieste. ICP is a unique scientific institution in that for 40 years it has been a hub for scientists from developing countries and still serves this this mission of helping out researchers from developing countries and new countries to perform research and higher education under the United Nations Organization for Education and Science. So the project, the project I'm going to discuss with you today started a long time ago, actually, when both Massimo and myself were in Institut Pasteur. But it didn't really start until Gautam came in, and so most of this wouldn't have been happening if not for the effort of Gautam, who is sitting here in the audience. So after this talk, I also invite you to exchange ideas with him as well. So our project starts from a very simple naturalistic observation that I think most of you, if not all, have done, is that birds are able to stay up in the air for long periods of time without flapping their wings. Not all birds, but some classes of birds. Of course, part of that is due to their aerodynamic structure, so which enables them to have a very, very small sink rate, which for this kind of birds which have very, very large wingspan can be of the order of 50 centimeters per second. In order to gauge how small is this sink rate, we might want to compare it with the sink rate of a man in wingsuit, which is more than one order of magnitude larger. And of course, it does not always work. Birds are, of course, endowed with the right anatomical structure to do this. But even more surprisingly, birds not only are able to stay up in the air, that is, to display this gliding behavior, which is, as a matter of fact, a fall, a very graceful fall, but it's just falling under the effect of gravity. But they can also soar. That is, they can go up in the air without flapping their wings. And this is, of course, a much more interesting behavior. It has attracted the interest of scientists since the end of the 19th century. This is a paper by Lord Rayleigh, who made very many important contributions to physics in different fields, from optics to fluid dynamics. And so Lord Rayleigh starts from the observation that if a bird is not flapping its wings, then it's just falling down. Okay. If it stays up, it might be just basically because of three reasons. So the first reason is that, if it's not flapping its wings, it's not going in a horizontal manner, so it's falling. Okay. Otherwise, there is a component of the wind which is not horizontal. Okay. So basically, there is some vertical velocity which is keeping the bird up. This vertical velocity of the wind might come from different sources. One of them might be, as we will discuss this in the following, atmospheric convection. That is, hot water tends to go up, and then hot air tends to go up, and then to provide some lift, which brings the bird upwards. Or, for instance, the slope of the terrain. There could be slope in the terrain, which also produces a vertical component of the wind, and then this could lead to vertical displacement. Yeah. Or, and that's the third possibility, the wind has no vertical component, but it has a vertical dependence in the intensity. It's a shear total. The situations in which there is low wind, and on top of this a region of high wind, and then in that case the bird, by a process which is called dynamic soaring, can learn to cycle through this low wind and high wind, and then keep up in the air for long periods of time without flapping that wings as well. Then Lord Kelvin goes on and discusses mostly this problem of dynamic soaring, but we will be interested mostly in another phenomenon, like I said, that is the phenomenon of thermal soaring. That is how birds exploit thermal currents to go up in the air. So this is an example of a peregrine falcon, which has been there's a GPS log on this peregrine falcon, which tracks its trajectory. So this is a typical example of trajectories, and these helicoidal shapes that you see are understood to be situations in which there is some upwind current generated by a thermal, and then the bird is going up, spiraling up to a certain height, in this case just a few hundred meters. In fact, birds can exploit these ascensional currents, these updrafts, to go to very, very large heights. So this is there is evidence of a collision between a vulture and an aircraft over Africa. This is from the 70s. So there was this collision, then the plane had to make an emergency landing, and then they went into the engine and they discovered that, well, the remains of a rapel vulture, so there were feathers and bones, etc. So they were able to know what kind of species that bird was, and it was at the height of 37,000 feet, so it's extremely high level. So they are able to do so by exploiting the strong updrafts that form inside these very large towering clouds that are called cumulonimbi. So this is one particularly extreme situation, but birds routinely can go up to thousands of meters. There are recent data, for instance, that concern long-term, long-distance migrators. So this is a collection of data taken with the frigate birds. So frigate birds are particularly interesting birds. They migrate all the way from South Africa to Southeast Asia, crossing the Indian Ocean. It's a trip of several thousand kilometers that they cover in about 1 month or so. Frigate birds are particularly interesting because their feathers are not waterproof. So while they cross the ocean, they don't have the opportunity to spend a lot of time sitting on water and resting. So these frigate birds have been logged with GPS and other instrumentation, which allowed the biometrics group to obtain very detailed information about their flight characteristics. So they discovered that 90% of the time there were no or rare wing widths. So they are basically soaring and gliding for 90% of the time. They travel between heights of 30 to 2,000 meters. They approach the surface episodically just to feed, basically. So they get down, they feed on fish, and then they restart again. And during that short period of time, they flap their wings. So it's a very interesting situation. And you see that the kind of trajectories that they do, they are are the following ones. They catch up some ascending currents, probably a thermal, then they go up in the air to a certain height, and then they decide to leave this thermal, this ascending current, and they start gliding to the base of the next thermal. So they have to decide where to go, which one will be the promising thermal, which will give them some energy. And so basically, they are acting just like sort of engines which extract energy from the atmosphere, transform this into vertical and then horizontal motion. Of course, the general cues for migration, that they have to go eastward, etc., are dictated by other mechanisms. But the local navigation is essentially governed by the details of the atmospheric dynamics of the atmosphere.
Are they following the monsoon winds here?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't remember the season. The general. This is a problem which the problem we're focusing on takes place on the scales of a kilometer or so. So the general navigation properties are, of course, guided by several cues, which including large-scale atmospheric currents and celestial navigation and compasses and etc., but on the very short time scale, that's what we're focusing on.
Do we have flock of birds or any single birds migrating?
It could be something collective, yes. But we will be focusing on the following, just on a single bird behavior. Yeah, but it's of course irrelevant.
So, you know, there's a lot of animals that go in that particular time from India to Africa, including dragonflies, Amur falcons, mm-hmm. and they seem to be following very similar tracks.
Yeah.
But very high.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, these kind of tracks are common, like I said, but we're more interested in the short time behavior over the scales of less than 1 hour and scales of about a kilometer, how to catch up these thermals, exploit them, and then eventually possibly decide what the next one is.
Those thermals, are they more or less stable?
I will go in great detail for this. The answer is no. Whereby, I mean, stable is that their lifetime doesn't go beyond 1/4 of an hour, 20 minutes, half an hour. Okay, so of course when you look into this kind of complex behaviors, the questions you're asking is how could they possibly do it? And that's the usual set of questions. What do they need to sense from the environment? What is the input for them to recognize what kind of atmospheric structures are useful for that? And how do they turn this information into behavior? Okay, so one possible way of going into this is just like we saw many examples during these days, is just to go for the specific case and try to dissect all these mechanisms at the level of neuroscience and cognitive structures that dissect this behavior. We will take a very different route. We will just take inspiration from this phenomenon and abstract away and formulate a general problem of navigation, which, of course, is still related to the original situation. So we will be discussing about observables which are reasonably accessible to a bird or to some unmanned aerial vehicle, for instance, and then map this into a sequence of maneuvers, which are, of course, something that a bird can do. But we will try to look for the simplest possible model that is able to recapitulate this behavior. So we will look into minimal input from the environment and a minimal set of actions that can be taken. So actually, this kind of questions about sensory inputs which are mapped into actions, in which case this case are navigational actions, are of course can be cast into the more general, much more general framework, which is the framework of decision making. So it's useful to think about this kind of problems into the setting of decision making. So, and in particular, the kind of basic concepts that we are going to use are the following ones. So, in the general setting of decision making, including navigation, the idea is that there is an agent, and this agent has receives some informations from the environment, which go under the name of percepts. And of course, we will have to specify what kind of observations are accessible to it. And then, in return to this, gives produces some actions, and these actions have an effect on its environment, and so on and so forth. So this continuous feedback between the state of in which the agent is and the state of the environment is what makes this particular problem interesting. In particular, one setting of this decision-making problem, which is particularly relevant for us, is reinforcement learning. So reinforcement learning is one branch of machine learning which exactly deals with this problem of a repeated interaction of the environment. It's basically it's unique in this sense with respect to other branches of machine learning.
Can I ask just a simple clarifying question? Why do you invoke decision making as opposed to just, you know, nobody would say that the thermostat is making good decisions, right? It's just a tuned.
Because there's a goal here, and the goal would be, for instance, to identify the thermal and go as up as high as possible, or.
Thermostat has a goal to keep the room comfortable, right? So it regulates output.
If you want to build a thermostat, you have to face a problem of optimal control. It's just a very simple one. This is a very complicated one.
I think many people think of decision making, right, as something which has a discrete nature to it,
These are details. So optimal control, decision making, they are all within the same general concept. There's no real difference to it.
Just there's an element of anthropomorphism which seems unnecessary, right? Because we make decisions, whereas I don't think the thermostat makes a decision.
Well, okay. I'm fine with anthropomorphism. Okay. So.
Related to that question is the difference that you can have passive adaptation or you can have active. So when you say the action will modify the environment, you still will have a feedback on the next decision.
Yeah.
Like in the case of the thermostat, there's no effect of the thermostat onto the temperature.
Well, there is, yeah, because you switch on the heating or the cooling. Well, you can put the thermostat, the full air conditioning system into this setting as well. Okay. So what the idea about reinforcement learning is that there is a particular subset of observations which are called rewards, which are basically reinforcement signals, encouragements that the agent gets about the course of the action that it's taking. So it's a feedback from the environment which tells, okay, you're going in the right direction or not in the right direction. It's not a very sharp feedback in the sense that it's not told, okay, this was the best action to take at that moment, and then you learn it. It's a partial learning, and it's an encouragement, such as like nudging towards the right behavior. And of course, all the system has a goal. And the goal is a sort of long-term goal. So it's not about optimizing the rewards over just one cycle of interaction with the environment, but it's something that goes on. There are several actions have to be taken, and in the long term, then there will be a return. And this is the goal that the agent wants to optimize. So let's go to the specifics of this case at hand. So in this case, our agent is the glider. So the bird or any artificial glider that we will consider in the following. And the actions are basically the controls. So what kind of maneuvers can the bird or the glider do? Bank on one side, roll, all these kind of controls. What is the environment in this case? Well, the environment is basically anything that is outside the agent. So the situation of the agent with respect to the environment, the scene in which the agent lives, is given by its position in the environment, and of course everything that specifies the atmosphere state. And this is the big thing, because in order to specify the state of the atmosphere, you need an enormously large number of variables. So the state of the atmosphere at any given moment within a small subdomain of even just a few kilometers wide contains an enormously large number of degrees of freedom that which you would like to in principle to describe. You should have in principle to describe fully, but of course you can't. In this description, the reward is the immediate gain in height. So if the agent takes some action, banks on the right, then in a short time, say a few seconds, there will be some response and which will bring it a few meters upward or a few meters down, for instance. And this is the signal that things are going well or not well. Even though this is not the goal, to gain immediately velocity. The goal is to get as high as possible in the long run. So some actions which apparently look detrimental because you will be falling down, maybe they help you because they are taking you somewhere else where there is a larger updraft that you might want to exploit. And then, like I said, the observations represent just a partial vision of the full environment. It's a partial set of measurements. We can assume that basically birds rely on mechanical cues, so they can, based on their proprioception, they can extract information about the state, local state of the flow. That is, what are the velocities and accelerations of the wind around them. And of course, a large part of this will also be guided by visual cues. Okay, so is there anyone in your... Yes?
No, I had a question. It was about the notion of reward. So do you think that's associated with work? Like it's the amount of work that the bird is doing that will then be translated?
This could enter into the reward, except in this case, we focus on... The goal is just to gain height in the long run. But you could formulate problems which include the amount of work spent, etc. You can formulate cost functions and include them, but we don't. Here it's just we don't focus on this aspect of how much work is used.
Question. Yeah. About the environment, so I can imagine this convective flow, there are some cells. I will
describe it in a second. Yeah.
What will you need the reward to be the immediate gain in height?
It's just over a very short time scale, a few seconds.
But
the task extends over a longer time, minutes to hours.
That's the humor. I mean, you want to define it this way, but in the real way, I mean, the animal, if he knows that he has a reward in 10 minutes, it's probably fine for him, right?
And what?
For the bird. Like if he needs to go down in order to get to his point where he's going to go up or not, then the reward is positive, and he can see that from visual cues, for instance. If he has a way to see that, you know, a few hundred meters away, there's a big ascending flow.
Yeah, but the problem is that while you get there, the environment is also changing. Okay, so this is what you estimate will be your reward in the end. But the reward is what you experience, is what you get in return from the environment. So it's important, this question of time scale. So the reward is something that you get immediately, right? So the usual situation is that you might choose some greedy behavior, so you want to exploit something in a very short run, or you might want to focus on the long-term behavior. For some things, for some decision-making problems, there is no difference. But from others, it's very different the strategy that you follow if you're greedy from the one that you...
Yeah, I agree. So.
Yeah, right.
So, do you expect to describe this also? So, the story we hear when it's going on the spiral, it's clear, is it described by that. Do you expect to describe the finding the next?
Yes, exactly. Thank you for the question. So, for today, we will just focus on the problem of starting somewhere in the middle and then getting high,
okay,
without the decision of leaving the thermal and getting to the next one.
Okay,
so this is cut into parts, and this is just the first part of the problem. Thank you.
So the cost function is the height of the bird?
The cost function would be minus the height gained. Yeah, but you can define different reward functions. But yes, the higher you go, the better you're performing. That's for this particular task of exploiting the ascensional currents.
Do you also punish for loss in height?
So you do it just, in this case it's just algebraic. It's a plus if you go up, it's a minus if you go down. It's not particular. Yeah.
What's on your next slide?
So this is how it works, and the important thing is that this kind of learning provides you a way to discover strategies, that is, a way to couple percepts to interactions without having to model in detail the environment. So you don't have to assume that birds know the dynamics of the Navier-Stokes equation or whatever atmospheric models describes your flow. Okay, they will just learn how to react to the system out of experience. So let's go a little bit into the details of how these various things are implemented in our approach. So actions are actually very simple. The only thing we basically consider is a change in the bank angle. So the only way these virtual birds will have to maneuver just by changing in this direction. We also had some results about the change in the angle of attack, but they don't actually seem to be a very important additional control, so it doesn't change much the results, so I will not discuss them, basically. So there's just one unique way to control this glider. About the environment, So again, this would be a synthetic environment which tries to mimic the real atmospheric boundary layer. It's a convective cells that is a box of about 1 kilometer size, which is heated from below, and then there is a sort of rigid lid at the top, which is cooler, and it's highly turbulent, which means that when we think about a thermal, you shouldn't think about this thing as a solid column which stays there forever, and you just have to discover where it is. It's something which is highly dynamic, so these are snapshots of the vertical velocity and snapshots of temperature. You see that there are regions where the velocities go up, and the temperature is higher, but this is very dynamic. The fine structure of this over the scale of 1 meter are extremely unpredictable, okay, which is the scale we are interested in, the scale of the bird. The lifetime of a thermal here, that is, the time that this structure is located roughly here, is about 15 minutes on this length scales, which means that in 15 minutes' time, these objects will be somewhere else, will be completely dissolved. And if you compare this with the soaring velocities that the bird has, this is exactly comparable with the time that it takes you to go from bottom to top. So you have to make decisions on the basis of an environment which is fleeting and about to change while you make your decisions.
What do we know about the statistics of the distribution of those?
Everything. In this case.
So can you be sure that there will be another one once you've done that somewhere, you will find one in your surroundings and you'll be able to go up again?
So this object is completely, in our simulation, is completely homogeneous in this direction, so it there's no that particular location where they are pinned. They can be happening everywhere. At every time, you're sure that on average there will be as much vertical velocity as in the positive direction as in the negative direction. So air must go up as much as air goes down because it's not compressing in a particular direction. So it's there's a lot of numerical investigations about and experimental investigation about the properties of this kind of structures. They are a typical size, in which case it's related to the size of the box, but they basically have a core which is of the order of 50 to 100 meters. And again, but these structures are very fleeting and changing.
Are they recurrent during the whole year? Or like can...
Yeah, so in the real atmosphere, these things happen typically on a sunny day in the afternoon, where they're particularly powerful. Okay. In the night, there's nothing like that. The atmosphere is stable. It's totally stratified. And
during the night?
Sleeps. No, I don't know. The bird over the ocean, you mean?
Yeah.
No, over the ocean, that's a different situation. Okay, this is over ground, sorry. In the ocean, it's different because there's less stratification even over the night, and the situation is less modulated over day and night. Oh, sorry for this confusion.
How much control does the bird have over its own? To what extent is it an active versus a passive party?
Active? What do you mean, active?
Active meaning it's actually able to change its own course, as opposed to being blown away by the wind.
It depends on the strength of the flow, yeah. So the resulting flight is a combination of this. In still air, if it banks, it has perfect control over what it's heading. But if it's in turbulence, it will be carried away and turn, etc. So this is part of the problem. So it depends. I will discuss the following two situations in which turbulence is strong, so it tends to overcome the ability of the glider, and turbulence is weak, so the glider has better control. So like I said, this is highly dynamic and unpredictable. So observation, what can the bird reasonably measure? So we know for sure that there is a whole system of measurements in the bird's ear, which is able to act as a variometer, so be able to detect changes in height and as well as accelerometer in all possible directions. So we will assume that starting from this internal measurements, the bird is able to produce somehow an estimate of the wind velocity and acceleration and use this as input for its decision making. So, important thing is that these observations that we will be focusing on are just very local observations in time and space. So it's something which is averaged over the scale of a second, a few seconds, and it's a sample of the atmospheric flow over a scale of just the size of the bird, so a few meters. So these are very local environmental measurements from which the task is implicitly to infer large-scale properties. So something that happens on the scale of hundreds of meters is actually correlated with some very local measurements. And the task is, of course, to discover it and exploit this information to soar. So this, when you, according to this, these definitions of observations, actions, and rewards, then you can train your birds through this reinforcement learning.
Sorry, this is with the assumption that the animal is not doing much. There's not a lot of like self motion, right? And essentially, it's just able to directly.
There's no thrust. There's just
no thrust, no lift.
Gliding, whenever.
And the velocity is from integrating the acceleration or from the pressure change, or you don't.
The velocity.
It's getting the velocity by integrating.
So the dynamics of the bird is just given by very simple aerodynamics in which there's balance of forces.
I understand your model, right? Yeah. I mean, you're a god in the model. Right, so you have access to any of the dynamic variables, right? But you think the animal is getting the wind velocity by integrating what it's getting from?
Oh yeah, yeah. The way this information is transformed into these two, we of course don't know how the bird does, if it does it. If this is just a wild guess of what it could be, but I will tell you about what it does when it's not a bird, but. A glider, okay. In that case, we will have to do it for you.
It uses an accelerometer.
It uses accelerometer and met several other quantities in order to. There's a process in which you also use.
I don't see what it uses to measure its velocity relative to air, right?
Okay. It could use. A combination of visual cues and mechanical cues, and then. Compare the two to get the velocity.
There's no sensing of shear flow on the surface or something.
I don't know what birds do. With
vision, you have a height confound, right?
In vision, there's no vision.
With vision, you can't. I mean, it's a problem.
With vision,
you can't disambiguate height from forward speed. It's the ratio.
It's certainly.
You see them separately.
Yeah, I don't know how this could be implemented for your inner bird. Okay. So in this specific setting, you might go through a series of learning episodes in such that you start out with some random associations of measurements and banking decisions. And going through this iterative procedure, after many trials in the order of several thousands, you go from one initial behavior, which is this one. So it starts at about 400 meters, our virtual bird. And then performing these randomly chosen actions, it might basically fall down or go up, depending on just on luck. If it happens to be in the right place, it gets a positive fluctuation, might go up, or otherwise it just falls down. So here this is the behavior of the naive bird, which has no particular association between stimuli and controls and actions. But after these episodes, consistently, the bird is able to glide and find the base of the thermal, and then go up in this spiraling behavior. Okay, so to go a little bit into the specifics in this case, the controls, that is the actual action that a bird can take, are very simple. It just can. Stay in the same situation as it is. So if it's just like wings like this, it stays like that, or if it's that, it stays like that, or it can switch from one to another by changes of 15 degrees. So it's a very simple way of discretizing your space of possible controls, which otherwise is a continuum space, which is very large and very difficult to sample in practice. So this is a sort of tiling of the full action space. Observations are, we assume that they are vertical and angular wind accelerations, like I said. And these also are tiled, so they can be, we just don't deal with the continuum of these variables. We just consider them to be either negative or neutral, around zero, or positive. So we divide space in chunks. And the same for angular accelerations. So vertical acceleration is just how much the wind is accelerating downwards, the bird, and angular acceleration is how much it's trying to flip it on its side.
Can I ask you a question about what's known about the statistics of those eddies on the, I mean, the surface of the Earth? Are there certain characteristics, you know, like the sun, for example, is characteristic size of those eddies.
Yeah.
And so I imagine in the Earth there's probably some characteristic size, and also those in the North Hemisphere has rotation in one direction and southern.
These are small structures. There's structures of the order of a kilometer, so they're not much affected locally by the rotation. So you have in mind some structures which are much bigger, of the order of hundreds of kilometers, in which case they tend to be cyclonic or anticyclonic. But locally, these things doesn't happen much.
And so the birds can basically learn that when there's a draft, it's on the order of a few kilometers.
So they of course, they can learn what the typical size of those objects are by repeated experience. They can learn how high they are on average. But of course, these things themselves vary. So there can be situations in which your thermal is 200 meters large, some others is just, the core is just 10 meters large, and it depends on many, many variables. Also during the day it changes, and with general atmospheric conditions and meteorology. So it's, these are not sketchy Gaussian objects that it's easy to locate or model. Okay, so more quantitatively, so this is what I'm showing here are the two typical learning curves. So here is the number of episodes, and here's the gain in height. So in two different situations, like we said earlier, this is the first situation is in which basically the turbulence is moderate, in that the ratio of the mean updraft current to the speed of the bird is of the order of 0.5, and this in green is another situation in which the turbulence is slightly larger than the velocity of the bird. So in this case, the bird tends to be more transported, in this case, it's more active. Okay. So you see that after a certain number of episodes of the order 1,000, then this performance levels off. And we find something that is approximately our best strategy, which I will describe in a second in detail. So here, it's basically, if you collect many of these curves and look at the final behavior after learning for the trained birds, and you can plot them as a function of the turbulent intensity. So if you focus on the green, on the blue, line here, you see that at low intensity it starts out from somewhere around zero, then the larger the turbulence, the convection becomes, the larger the gain. Okay, so there are more opportunities, and this is basically roughly a linear curve. So more fluctuations means more possibility to rectify the turbulent motion into a vertical motion by the bird. Convert this into potential energy if you wish. But after a certain level, which is basically when these two things are in balance, where the turbulence starts to compete with the active motion of the bird, you see that this performance levels off and it goes on, increases, but at a much slower rate. Because here the problem is becoming much more difficult. Turbulence is strong, the kind of control that it can exert is limited, but also it's also very difficult to identify what is a real updraft current from what is just a wild fluctuation. So here there are more opportunities because there are stronger currents, but also the noise is larger. So it's difficult to tell apart which is real, a real good signal to exploit from what is just a fluctuation that inside a region that is actually not getting you to the top.
This second figure is a trained agent.
all these are trained. So all these are data points at the end of this. There are many, many of these learning curves. You pick the behavior at the end of the learning for different parameters. So this red curve here would be corresponding to this point, and this green curve here would correspond to this point.
How do these graphs evolve over time, like during the training?
So like I said, this is the result at the end of the training.
Yeah.
So these don't evolve. If you want to look into evolution, you would look, like to look into these learning curves. So this is over training. Okay. I mean, you could plot these curves also over time if you wish, but I don't know. I didn't do it. I don't know.
So you assume that the bird knows its own height, right?
No.
So how does it update its policy, its behavior according to the world?
Just maps the accelerations of the wind, that is, it has inferred, into decisions whether to bank more or less or stay. That's all it does. The height is a totally hidden variable in this process.
So this is input in form of vertical degree, vertical velocity.
In our case, it just receives directly the input as in the form of vertical accelerations of the wind and angular acceleration of the wind. But of course, there has to be some processing by a real bird to transform in from raw observables into these processed observables.
So this is acceleration of the vertical acceleration and also
angular acceleration of the wind.
It seems interesting that the turbulence, a little bit of turbulence helps.
Yes?
What's the mean flow in your case? In other words,
zero.
It is zero. Okay, so then you need that. So you don't have it yet. So it's all okay. So that's what you count as you are analyzing.
You have to rely only on fluctuations.
Only fluctuations.
Yeah.
So that's not Rayleigh's initial insight, I thought.
Sorry?
Rayleigh's initial insight, which he points out, the turbulence is a key factor. So that kind of shows up here.
Okay, so at the end of the learning, what you end up with is actually a decision-making table, okay, which is called the policy, and it's 20 years. So these are all the possible states in which all possible observations that can be made by the bird at any given time. So this is the vertical acceleration of the wind. This is a torsional acceleration or torque. Acceleration, and like I said, it's just like minus minus means that it's going to be larger negative, etc., etc. So you have 3x3, 9 possible observations at any given interval of time of the order 1 second. These are the possible bank angles, and the actions are just increase it by 5 in this case, or stay. Or decrease it by 5, sorry, increase it or decrease it by 5, etc. So from this table, which is the outcome of this learning process, you can learn a strategy. And you can do this for the two different cases, where the turbulence is relatively weak or it's strong, again, compared to the wind, to the airspeed of the bird.
So I'm not going to miss that. I want to go back to that question. So the turbulence speed here, how does it compare to the actual AD motion that you have?
It's all turbulence.
Sorry?
It's all turbulence. These structures form
so
out
have
of turbulence.
No periodicity whatsoever.
I have periodicity in the lateral domain, I have boundaries here, but everything acts out of just this temperature difference from top to bottom.
So it's homogeneous in the horizontal direction?
It's totally homogeneous in the horizontal direction.
But so in the atmosphere, don't you have the actual, at some point, you have a big updraft.
Yeah, but this the position where the updraft and draft is, it changes with time, right?
Yes.
So it's there for
but
some
it
minutes and
it stays for a while.
Exactly, and the point is that the time that it stays up is comparable to the time that you need to go up. So the time that you have to complete your task is comparable to the lifetime of the structures.
So if the bird is in the middle of the updraft, in addition to the turbulence, you have another general updraft.
Yeah.
So the bird just gets lifted without
yeah.
doing anything.
But the point is that initially the birds are everywhere, all over the place. They don't know where they are. They might be in a downdraft or an updraft. They have to discover what to do depending on just these local observations. They do not. You can see this picture of these updrafts and downdrafts in my graphs, but of course, any agent wouldn't see it. The only thing that they can see visually, for instance, is that, okay, maybe at the base of the, at the top of the troposphere, there are clouds forming. This is good indication that there's, but these birds don't.
The URMS here relates to the actosphere.
This is, yeah, this is exactly, this is the vertical RMS fluctuation. So like if I get back a second to that slide. So here, the efficiency is exactly what we're talking about. It's just the ratio of this green, this red curve is the ratio of how much you can gain, how much you really gain with respect to the fact if you are able to collect all the positive fluctuations only in vertical velocity. So this would be the ideal bird. And you see that it goes up to something like 20%, then degrades. So you just 1/5 of the time you get the right thing. So this is a table which basically encodes for behavior that's produced by these learning algorithms. It's of course a little bit complicated to read. The only thing I wanna mention here is that there are remarkable differences in the behavior in weak turbulence and strong turbulence. So if you focus on this particular column, which means that the situation of the wind here is generally neutral, so there are no strong accelerations in either vertical or angular direction of the wind. And if the turbulence is weak, basically what this policy tells is just bank away. Okay. So it says this is not a position where you want to stay if the turbulence is weak, because you're not exploiting enough of the ascensional current. On the contrary, if turbulence is strong, the behavior is opposite. You want to stay there because it's safer. It's basically that's at least how we interpret this different behavior in these two different situations. And another way of illustrating this is here is just this basically same concept. This is a situation in which there is a negative angular acceleration, so the bird is experiencing some wind which is sending it away in this direction, and it might react by counteracting this tendency by banking in the opposite direction. And as you see, this decision to bank away from this torque depends on how strong it's falling down. That is, how strong the force is bringing downwards. So if it's falling down at a very high rate, if it's pushed down strongly, then it banks away a lot. So it decides to take an action which takes it away as much as possible, contrasts this behavior. Whereas if the turbulence is high, this behavior is strongly reduced. So there's a tendency of taking more moderate actions. So this is a sort of, in a sense, a more risk-averse decision to take taken by these virtual birds. Okay, so the last point that I want to address for these virtual birds is why should one select these two particular observables that we picked out? Right? Of course, it's very difficult to start in very general terms, so allowing this bird to have a very large set of observables and then extracting the useful ones. This is, of course, a very interesting question, but we did not address. What we did in this case is just try several combinations guided by some physical intuition, or what could be the inputs that could be helpful for learning this behavior, and then comparing the performances. So for instance, this column here is what I've been showing until now. It's a combination of inputs which comes from vertical and angular wind accelerations here. Here we had more observables, so also the vertical velocity and temperature, and you see the performance is not much larger. Here we added also some control on the attack angle, and the performance is not particularly interesting. So separately, torque and acceleration give slightly less performance. Vertical velocity is not particularly useful, and temperature does not produce any. So these are interesting observations in that they tell you something about the fluid dynamics. Because some observables carry more information about the large-scale properties of the flow that you want to exploit, and some others don't. Because in particular temperature, it's an object which is highly fluctuating and nearly homogeneously mixed in this particular region, so it's not a good cue. So we could make sense of this particularly shortfall of learning with temperature. But of course, this cannot exhaust all possible combinations of any mechanical cues that could be observed. Neither it considers the possibility that might be more complicated strategies based on memory, which we don't consider in this case, but might be in place for birds.
Question, I compare the second from the left to the third bars. So you're adding three more components. The second one was AZ plus tau, and the third one, you're adding a few more components, and the performance, the learned performance is low.
So why
it doesn't learn to ignore that? The performance is low. I understand that the time to learn may be longer, having more performance. Why the total performance is lower?
I don't know the answer to that. I guess that, again, it's a problem of being able to associate this. This might be distracting information, right?
So but if you should learn to zero it.
Yeah, in the long run. But we have just a finite set of episodes we run, and we compare this over thousands of episodes. Perhaps after 30,000 episodes, then it levels to the same. I don't know. Maybe Adam has tried something longer than that.
It doesn't learn to control the angle of attack.
Say it again? It
doesn't learn to control the angle of attack.
So in this case, you also have an additional control. In addition to observables, you also have a control. The difference between this and this is that you also control the angle of attack, and not only just the bank angle. So you have an additional thing that you have to learn, and perhaps that's the incomplete learning.
It's not more information, it's more control.
But basically it's a limited time of learning. Yeah, then it should kind of work.
If you try to benchmark it by some optimal observer, like maybe just by estimating it without the reinforcement learning, have a matrix.
If you want to formulate this problem in terms of optimal control, you should have access to states, and that would be that every time you should give the snapshot of the fluid over the full domain. These are the Markovian variables.
No, what I mean is that if you have, you show the matrix of the decision matrix,
yeah.
Right? So you can just go through it, simulated annealing or this PD algorithm, and optimize the.
You want to sample across different strategies and see whether there are any ones. No, I don't think we did this, did we?
No. Hey, what was the question? The
question was if we...
Like brute forcing through the matrix and trying to see what the optimal policy is. Because the matrix is small. It's not like very general.
Well, like four or five variables, it becomes quite big.
But they're binary.
Curious, yeah.
Okay, so let me move to the final part of the talk, where we just move into a practical problem that is how to control sailplanes in an automated way in order to achieve such kind of behavior. Of course, this is very interesting from a technological application viewpoint, because if you are able to implement some autopilot which can extract energy out of the turbulent convection, then you can save a lot in terms of power consumption. Sailplanes are a thing, and so they have incredibly performance. So these are guided by humans, of course, but these are the kind of performance that you can have with sailplanes across. They can fly in thousands of kilometers in one afternoon, and then can go to extreme heights. These are extremely powerful vehicles. Autonomous sailplanes or hybrid structures already exist. So this is one of them. It's powered, and there are solar panels powered, but it can switch into gliding mode depending on on the control. So of course these are kind of ideal structures in which ideal systems in which you can decide to switch from gliding to energy saving to powered motion at any given time. So Gardam and Jérôme rather did experiments with a glider. This is a motor glider, 2 meters wide in wingspan. These are just commercially available, and of course they added to this remote control gliders also additional instrumentation and autopilot system. Basically, the task here is to see whether it's possible to implement this reinforcement learning scheme in order to learn how to soar in the field. So here again, the problem, which is the same kind of problem that we suppose birds have to face, is to convert raw input from the instrumentation into these observables that we were focusing on, which are again vertical and angular acceleration. So the way that the workflow works is that there is the input from several instrumentation, including GPS, compass, and barometer, etc. So you have a lot of information coming from different means. This is first processed, but it's filtered out and combined to give other observables, basic observables, such as the sink rate, the rate at which you're falling with respect to the ground, the pitch, which is the angle with respect to the horizontal, the bank angle and the speed with respect to the air, the airspeed. And then from this, there's a last step to be taken to extract how much of this is coming from the wind. In order to do that, you need a dynamical model. You need to describe how the glider responds to fluctuations. Okay, so this can be done. It's aerodynamics. It's relatively simple, but still non-trivial aerodynamics, which includes dynamical responses, that is, the tendency of oscillations in response to dynamical behavior. All these kind of things have to be included. And then after you do that, you're able to extract, as a difference from the predicted behavior and the observed one, this difference between these two curves, the orange one and the blue one, gives as a result the component of the, here in this case, of the angular acceleration that comes from the wind velocity. Okay, so this is a kind of what we might speculate that happens in the bird's brain, in the way that by which proprioception or heteroception is actually converted into setups of observables which are useful for learning the task. But of course, this for bird is just speculation. And then a series of trials were conducted near San Diego. So initially, there was a sort of exploratory strategies by which these gliders were just flying around and sampling the flow and measuring these observables and then taking action at randoms and collecting experience. And then from this first sort of set of observation, then offline, there was a learning part by which a new strategy was produced, and then to the same kind of methods of reinforcement learning, eventually they were able to observe these kind of trajectories in the field, in which this glider is able to catch up the terminal and then go up by a few hundred meters. So if you compare the results of a random strategy with the one that is learned, you see that there is some reasonable increase in performance, which turns out to be statistically significant, even though, of course, it's not an enormous difference in quantitative terms. Very interestingly, when you look at the strategy, so when you look at this matrix which maps observations into actions, okay, so this is very much like the matrix I was showing earlier. Now the interesting thing is that when you look at the behavior in this in this subset of rows, it very much resembles a rule, an empirical rule, by which was initially proposed by Reichman, who actually was a cross-country glider, so a pilot, self-paying pilot. And he said exactly, when the climb improves, you have to flatten the circles, that is, you have to reduce the bank. Okay, if you read out the components here, in this case, when the climb improves, this means that you have a sense that you're going up, then you have to reduce the banking angle, and when it's going taking you down, you have to increase the bank angle, and if it remains constant, you have to stay there. So, besides the actual figures, 15 degrees, 20 degrees, which depend on the kind of vehicle that is gliding, you see that qualitatively this resembles very much this rules. Okay, so that's basically where I want to go. Summarizing, it seems that this reinforcement learning approach provides a very straightforward way of connecting percepts into controls, which allow to even to discover these strategies for particularly demanding tasks such as navigation in very highly unpredictable and dynamic environments such as the atmosphere. Of course, there are several things which are left unaddressed. One of them is we don't know whether these are the best observables one can cook up even among the local ones or over the time scales of a few seconds or minutes. So is it possible to address this question? Well, there are now technical tools from machine learning which allow to attack this question from a more general perspective. So the idea basically is that there is a streaming of data that which comes to the decision maker, and then by repeated interaction again with the environment, so by making the thing, by optimizing the goal, in the meanwhile also a representation of the world is produced which is relevant for that goal in an automated way. Often this representation is not very transparent, so we often don't know what the outcome of this processing of the raw input is, but it would be interesting nonetheless to look into this. And so like it was prompted at the beginning, many of these birds do navigation in groups, so they often look at each other from one side to the other of the thermal and make decisions based on what the other birds is actually doing at that particular point. So it would be certainly interesting to address this problem as well. The theoretical tools are already there. So there is a whole branch which is called multi-agent reinforcement learning, which basically couples ideas from learning with ideas from game theory. Whether in this case would be a cooperative game, but there might be other situations in which there is more adversarial games at work. And finally, of course, there's a whole set of problems in olfactory research, again with birds or other animals, which could be addressed basically by the same kind of theoretical tools and concepts. And with that concluded, I'm happy to take any other question if you have.
Did you ever look at the flying fish, you know, the one that are coming out of the water, and they use their
microphones
to
light? Yeah, I know this. I've seen many of them. Côte d'Azur. But I was fascinated by it. Yeah, no, we never looked into that.
So any ideas how with this approach, how with this framework to approach the global search, not the local search, but
yeah.
The global search?
Yeah, That's a project which is currently underway. So in this case, we are coupling the problems of getting height to decide where to live, when to live, and how to point to the next thermal.
And how to find the next, but exactly. The optimization function is not local. I mean,
yeah, sure, time, sure it is. It's on a longer time scale, right? And then in that case, you would have to set a task, for instance, go in that direction as far as possible, or go away from where you are as far as possible.
What potential cues animal glider agent can extract to find the next thermal?
So in practice, if it's on the ground, There are many useful visual cues, for instance. If the land is rocky, then it's likely to be a situation where there's a strong convection. If it's in the sun or if it's in the shade, at the border between forest and crop, there's also a large possibility that there's. Or in the sea, of course, the sea doesn't give much information. But if you look at the sky, like I said, you can see the formation of clouds at the base, at the top of the atmospheric boundary layer. So when you see the sky is scattered with clouds, basically there's one thermal at the base of each cloud. So you can use this as a reference for. Yeah, but you have to combine different information other than this one in order to address the full task.
Have you tried a complete agnostic approach, meaning that they don't actually try to estimate the state of the environment? All they measure is just the self state and they give it reward.
Well, no, we didn't. That's the short answer. I would like to know more about what you have in mind. So in a sense, they are.
So if, as long as they reward when they feel they're going up. But they don't have to estimate the wind velocity or the wind acceleration. And they form a rule just according to your
But then you would have to specify what means going up. Means that with respect to the ground, then they would have to measure the distance from the ground somehow. So there has to be some external.
As long as your mean acceleration is up, you're not going to.
But the birth acceleration that can be sensed by proprioception might be just due to the fact that it's a combination of factors.
So they have ears. That's why they can think of this, because they actually have ears, so they can have acceleration.
I don't know whether we tried with the. We're just using the birth accelerations, not the wind acceleration,
just the birth acceleration.
As long as it's
So you found that there's using temperature information is not helping at all. Because animals should be as good at measuring small temperature changes as they are at measuring things like velocity.
Yeah.
Right. So even I think most animals are sensitive to tenths of a degree changes.
Yeah.
But you find
it doesn't seem just to be the right cue for this particular task.
Sure.
That's what I'm saying. If you look at this situation, basically, the correlation between the vertical velocity and the temperature, which is a measure of the turbulent flux of heat, is basically a substantially uniform.
But if you enter one direction. Of these cells, right, just the process of going from outside to inside, a convective cell, presumably you get.
Presumably, but it turns out that it is.
About pressure gradients.
We didn't try.
So what happens if the bird knows the nozzle on the height?
If it knows the height? I don't think we fed this input.
I mean, I've tried it, but it's not a good state variable. Because it's not Markovian, I mean. You need.
But neither acceleration is for that. Sorry. None of our observers is truly Markovian, so it's.
But it turns out that the learnability of the system is somehow related to how Markovian your states are. And height is much worse than velocities, which are much worse than accelerations.
Yeah, if you want height stores more history in the past, then the local acceleration is something that is local instantaneous fluctuation. So. That might be one way of rationalize this, but
Great, thank you.